Okay, any preliminary issues, questions, problems? Okay, I gave you a brief sort of overview of the transition from looking at ways of establishing negligence to this next section on vicarious liability, which is attributing negligence to a deeper pocket. There are a couple of important issues in the Hayes case, but there's also other stuff that we'll need to look at in the notes and elsewhere to kind of make sure we understand this this principle here. Mr. Green, can you tell us about Hayes? Okay. Now, just so we're clear on the terminology here, the defendant that the plaintiff is after is not this individual attorney, at least for purposes of this opinion. It's the employer, the law firm, that is the target defendant. So maybe we could talk about the attorney or what's his actual name here? McGrath. There's McGrath and then the defendant law firm. Okay. So the plaintiff's burden here is to establish that the law firm is responsible for what McGrath did the night of the shooting. Okay, so the plaintiff, in trying to make this case, draws upon a previous Washington case. What's that? Yeah. The plaintiff says, in effect, this case, like Dickinson, permits imposition of liability on the employer. Now, let's make sure we understand what happened in Dickinson and see how well the facts kind of square up, how close the analogy is between Dickinson and this case. What's going on in Dickinson? Actually, at a banquet, a Christmas party. Many employers have an annual Christmas party, something like that, to invite their employees. Alcohol is served. Alcohol is consumed. Okay, then what? Okay. Okay. Now, just so we're clear on this, at the time the collision occurs and the plaintiff gets injured, at that moment is the employee in the course and scope of his employment? Yes or no question? He is in the course and scope of employment when the collision occurs? Okay. But, you point out, that's not the end of the story because the plaintiff's claim in Dickinson was that he was in the course and scope of employment when... Yeah. Nice work if you can get it. that the finding of the court is that it was part of his job to consume alcohol. At least, now again, when we talk about being in the course and scope of employment, we don't necessarily affirm the particular thing the employee was doing. So, for example, if a guy from Safeway is intoxicated and exceeding the speed limit and cuts somebody off in traffic, he's still in the course and scope of employment, even though the employer has many times made it clear that you're supposed to be sober and obey the speed limit and so forth. But when we ask the question, was this person in the course and scope of employment, whether they're drinking at this banquet or driving a truck, the question is, were they doing something the employer wanted them to do, albeit doing it badly? Just as the guy in Stevens in the trolley case, he's driving the trolley, although he negligently disobeys his employer's instruction to ring the gong before he gets to the intersection. Okay, so in Dickinson, you got somebody negligently drinking, which later leads to this collision that injures the plaintiff. By the time the collision occurs, the guy's outside the course and scope of employment. He's left the job, but in effect, the consequences of his earlier negligence are visited upon the plaintiff, and that's why the employer is held vicariously liable. How well does that fit McGrath and Hayes and all that stuff? Okay. Okay, and in fact, to the extent that the law firm might say, well, going to the bar, ordering a plate of appetizers, yeah, okay, order a beer while you're doing that, but don't get completely looped and try to do the firm's business. We could get into some serious trouble if you're trying to conduct law firm business at the same time you are legally intoxicated. How do we know they can't make that argument? The law firm can't deny that he was doing the firm's business, not just by going to the bar, but on this particular occasion. But they could still say that he was off the reservation at that point. Yes, ma'am. They billed for the hours. You'd think that the law firm worried that they might, you know, wanting to kind of distance themselves from this guy. Apparently he's no longer employed by the firm. You'd think that the law firm would say, we can absorb the loss of the income from those, whatever, two and a half hours that he billed. Let's say, gee, McGrath, it's not that we have a policy, never go to a bar, never attract clients, but on this particular day, he was clearly not. No, the law firm went ahead and billed the hours, so they're stuck with the finding that he was acting in the course and scope of employment, sitting there at the bar drinking. What else do we need to know from Dickinson? Okay. And again, why was that true in Dickinson? Okay, and how well does that fit the facts here? Now let's pause on that for just a moment and consider the fact that if I overconsume alcohol, what is the likelihood that I'm going to get into an accident driving a motor vehicle? Okay, but it's still pretty small. I mean, you probably, from your own personal experience, have observed people that walked out of your house or walked out of the bar and thought, wow, it'll be a miracle if they get home alive. And there's the miracle. You know, they show up for work the next day, and yeah, they got home. My goodness. So it's not as though over-consuming alcohol at the banquet made it likely, more probable than not, that he was going to... It just increased the risk that something bad was going to happen when he drove home. Now, with respect to McGrath, what is the factor that would arguably lead a reasonable person to restrict their alcohol consumption? Among other things, first of all, he's trying to bill hours for his law firm. You would think, even though I'm a good social, you know, convivial person here, I shouldn't get legally intoxicated, Mr. Breck. Yeah. Well, now, he doesn't have it on his person. He got it in his car. Does that make it analogous to Dickinson to say, just as the person knew he was at greater risk of getting into an automobile accident, if I have a firearm in my car, I'm going to a bar, what happens when I drink? My judgment about how to resolve disputes gets somewhat distorted, and things that as a sober person I would recognize would be a terrible idea, suddenly with a few, you know, as the blood alcohol content rises, these prospects take on a, you know, attractive new form, you know, just like that person down the, you know, a couple of seats down in the bar, you know, takes on a much more attractive form after I've got a few in my system. So does that make him negligent that knowing that he's now at higher risk of thinking that the firearm will be a useful way to settle some dispute, does it make him negligent for consuming alcohol? Mr. Breck? There are several reasons to question his judgment in getting as intoxicated as he did. He's supposedly practicing law. He's got to drive home. He's got a firearm in the car. But of those first two, practicing law and driving home, neither of those two obligations resulted in the problem. It was the use of a firearm that created the problem. Is there enough of a connection between the potential for misusing this firearm that would make his consumption of alcohol negligent? The court says no. It was in the course and scope of employment, but guess what, folks? It wasn't negligent. Now, ordinarily, who makes that call? Who decides whether something's negligent or not? Jury. In this case, the court decides on summary judgment as a matter of law what he did was not negligent. I would have been tempted if I had been on the court to say, significant burden the plaintiff will have to show that, unlike a car, which I know I have to drive, I'm not anticipating using a firearm. That's where the two situations are really not analogous. If, for example, he knew he was going to be going to the target range or something, or he was going to be doing something where he knew he was going to have to handle the firearm, then you can kind of draw the analogy a little bit closer. But on the flip side, you would think that whereas, as I was saying earlier, even a drunk person has a pretty good chance, not nearly good enough, I want to make clear, but still a very good chance of getting home sober, even though they're getting home safely, even though they're driving while intoxicated, once the decision is made to use a gun, our complaint is not, gee, a sober person would have done a better job handling the firearm. It's the very decision to use the gun that we're worried about. That because he was intoxicated, he then chose this method of dispute resolution where a sober person would not. But the court doesn't buy the connection. They don't see that getting more alcohol in your system increases the risk that you're going to misuse a firearm. They see that as something that's essentially unforeseeable. Mr. Fowler? Why would it then, why would that change things in the court's mind, do you think? Even two fights. Even one fight. Right. That would make his conduct negligent. But remember what the court is telling us as a matter of law is that sitting there when the waiter or the waitress comes around and asks him if he wants another drink, that he's not acting unreasonably by ordering another drink. What the court is saying is if he knew enough about himself or if he had some reason to think, gee, I've got to meet this guy in the parking lot later on. But sitting there, the court reasons, he had no reason to believe that there was any risk to anybody from consuming alcohol, except for these other two things that didn't happen. He could make bad judgments in his legal work, or he could, get into his car later on. Ms. Ma? Well, there is a requirement, and in fact it applies even to such august institutions as the Gonzaga Law School Student Bar Association. If an organization like the Bar Association, Student Bar Association, hosts a banquet where alcohol is served, that organization is under an obligation to use reasonable care in evaluating whether to refill somebody's glass, or if you bring bottles of wine or you have a keg of beer where you go over and serve yourself, the lack of any sort of control over the consumption of it may make that employer liable. Now, as a practical matter, you may figure the chances of somebody over consuming and getting into an accident are high enough, you don't want to be in a position of explaining, yeah, but we made an evaluation of this person and they seemed like they were sober at the time and the decision we made to refill their glass was a reasonable one. If you don't want that risk, you may say, in effect, we're not going to have these kinds of parties anymore. Or we're going to have parties in which, everybody turns in the keys at the door as they come in, and nobody drives home. By the way, you may know that in other cultures, other societies, in Europe or in Japan, comparable economic status, lots of people like to drink, bars are very popular. No one would dream of getting in their car even after, two drinks. I mean, I remember my brother who lives in Japan, visited me and was horrified that I had a beer at lunch one day, thinking, well, you can't drive now. Well, we accept that as I do. We're on vacation. I want to make this very clear here. That's not shocking to an American the way it would be. And basically people in other civilized countries have been trained, in effect, you can drive, you can drink, but you don't do either one of them, even in modest quantities, whereas we have a culture in which it's acceptable to gauge for yourself, and then lots of people get into lots of trouble as a consequence. But in any event, this guy, the court says, was not negligent in deciding to have more. Mr. Wright? Yes. Well, just to be difficult and have rocks thrown at me, I like to read Camille Paglia, who's this crazy woman, offends just about everybody, right, left, whatever. But one of the things that she talks, she's a feminist, but she's appalled at people who drink and go to frat parties, for example. She said, you know, I'm from a traditional Italian family, and, you know, talks about that. I would just say, to the extent that you might say, it doesn't excuse what Kobe, you know, I'm not going to go into all that. It's not to say that it's any different, but you would say, gee, from a standpoint of a reasonable person, self-protection, drinking impairs your ability to fend off the attacker and to make good judgments about where you're going and so forth. So not ATM, but in other contexts, you would say this is something a reasonably prudent person, for their own safety, would, just as you exercise good judgment about, will I have to drive, will I put myself in a situation where I'm vulnerable to something really bad happening to me. So now, again, that as I say, at the risk of offending everybody's sensibilities on that point, I would say there is a case to be made when you flip it around to say, not that this excuses the bad behavior of the other person, but is that something a reasonable person would take into account for their own safety? I think the answer is yes, they would. Now, is it understandable, you know, and so forth and so on? Just as you could say in this case, is it understandable that he's not thinking he's going to use his gun later on? We're not thinking that as the waitress offers to bring him another gin and tonic or what have you, that he's thinking, well, gee, I've got a gun out in the car. But on the other hand, even if he doesn't have a history of violence, you might be concerned about his exercising judgment, particularly if he's practicing law in a contentious environment, he kind of puts on your aggressive streak, that will lead you to make bad decisions about how to resolve the kinds of things that happen in bars. I mean, we know that bars are places where people get into fights and, you know, do irrational things. So, but if in fact it is not specific to the gun, but in general that you could find a person was not using reasonable care for their own safety or for the safety of others, it's arguable that in a situation like that, the decision to become as intoxicated as he was a failure to use reasonable care. Wouldn't that ordinarily be a question for a jury, whether he was acting reasonably or not? Whereas the court says, as a matter of law, it was not a foreseeable result. Ms. Schmidt? let me just pause to emphasize that you're absolutely right. Something I want to make sure everybody understands. This is not about whether McGrath is liable for his conduct, because the problem for McGrath is it's not sitting there drinking that he's getting in trouble for. McGrath's getting in trouble for what he did out in the parking lot, and regardless of whether or not he thought there was any, you know, whether he was negligent for drinking, he certainly is answerable for what he did on the parking lot. Maybe the jury thinks he was acting in self-defense, but if they decide he wasn't and misused his firearm, he's in big trouble. But your point is precisely right, that what we're concerned about here is not whether McGrath has to pay for these injuries. It's whether the law firm has to pay for McGrath. And in particular, we're not saying the law firm is vicariously liable. We're not saying that McGrath was in the course and scope of employment when he was out in the parking lot. We're wondering whether he was in the course and scope of his employment when he's getting intoxicated. Ms. Williams. Well, again, the question is, for example, if you hire a driver for Safeway, and they're out driving their truck taking groceries from the warehouse to the retail stores, their job includes a whole variety of different things, you know, stopping someplace to refill their truck with fuel or what have you. As long as it's within the scope of trying to fulfill their job responsibilities, it's within the course and scope of employment, even though their job, their job is getting groceries from one place to the other. In order to do that, or as part of doing that, they may do other things. So he may, for example, Safeway may have him go speak to the local bring your dad to work day, where, you know, he goes as a Safeway truck driver and he drives his Safeway truck into the elementary school. You know, my dad drives a truck for Safeway. That's part of his job if Safeway knows about it and thinks, oh yeah, this will be a good thing to raise PR. So similarly, the idea that I go to a banquet and I consume alcohol, that's part of my job. Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, it can be. Now, does the employer want you to overconsume? Not likely. But just as the truck driver is employed to drive the truck, but with the expectation that it'll be done sober and the speed limit and so forth, if the employee is trying to do the thing but does it badly, that's still within the course and scope of employment. I'm sorry. Okay. Okay, sure. Yeah. Falls asleep. Oh, yeah. Oh, I see what you're saying. I think the causal connection would be much tougher with drowsiness, because once I leave the office, my options are greater with respect to drowsiness. I can pull over, I can do other things, so that I think it's harder to show that working late at the office caused the accident. In the same way, you can say, gee, once that alcohol got in the blood system, there was nothing I could do to, now, of course, I could have called a cab, but I think the causal connection is tighter than it is for drowsiness. Yeah, I think so, but it's an interesting concept. Okay, now, let's, again, the basic rule here is that the employer is liable, vicariously liable, for employees negligence while in the course and scope of employment. Now, there are two words here, and I'm not sure that there's any... when we say course and scope, that's, again, one of these sort of terms of art. And I don't mean to say one is one and one is the other, but there are actually two different issues that are important to think about. One is whether the employee is on the job. So that the difference between being at the banquet, you're on the job, driving home from the banquet, you're not on the job. And remember, while the guy's driving home from the banquet in Dickinson, he's not in the course and scope of employment. He was drinking in the course and scope of employment, but when he's on the highway, he's not on the job. The other, you might consider sort of the scope question is this part of your job? So, for example, if I engage in some kind of, suppose I get into I get one of these emails saying they have money in this bank account that's been locked because of some turmoil in Nigeria or whatever it is, and if I will only send them this money, they can make me millions. Have you gotten those emails? Yeah. Okay. Suppose I decide to start participating in this or doing one of them myself, and from my Gonzaga computer and with my Gonzaga email account, I start sending out solicitations to people to join in this financial venture, and bad things happen. Can Gonzaga University be held vicariously liable for the things I do in perpetrating this fraud? I think not. Gonzaga University would say DeWolf was not hired to participate in that. That's not in the scope of his employment. If he's running some fraud, fraudulent scheme, he happens to be using his Gonzaga email account, but that's not really in the scope of his employment. Now, most of the problems in scope of employment arise from intentional torts, where the employee does something they know, and often they're criminal. The employee knows that these things are wrong, and they do them anyway. It's a financial, fraudulent kind of scheme. Or, sad to say, a lot of it is sexual misconduct. So, for example, teachers or clergy or counselors or psychiatrists and so forth, physicians, get sued for sexual misconduct involving people that are in their care. Now, the plaintiff would like to utilize vicarious liability to attach the assets of the deep pocket, the church, the school district, the medical group, the hospital, what have you. And the difficulty with that is to show that this kind of abuse is within the scope of employment. And there were some early cases that kind of wrestled with this. I think the law is now pretty clear that all that stuff is outside the scope of employment, which isn't to say there isn't a vehicle for liability. I'll talk about that in a moment. But I just want to be clear that on the issue of vicarious liability, you can't hold the institution liable for things that are really outside the scope of employment. Now, again, the early argument from the plaintiffs, which had some kind of plausibility, is that the institution gave all of the badges of authority to the employee who essentially said, I'm here to help you, trust me, this will be good for you. So there was a case, for example, against the Orange County Sheriff's Department, against Orange County, where a sheriff had responded to a domestic call in Riverside or someplace in Orange County. In Riverside County. Anyway, someplace in Orange County, where the victim, a woman, was encouraged to go with the sheriff in his squad car for her protection or something, and utilizing that environment, the sheriff proceeds to sexually assault the victim. And when she sued the county and said that this was in the course and scope of employment, she said, you know, I never would have gotten into the squad car if you hadn't given him a badge and a car with the, you know, blinking lights and all that kind of stuff. He was working for you then, although he violated the rules. This is no different from the truck driver who's drunk and exceeding the speed limit. Here was a police officer who misused his position to assault me. And the court sided with her. But that was an aberrational case, and later cases have essentially reached the conclusion on the front of clergy or counselors or what have you, teachers who commit sexual assaults upon people that have been groomed in this kind of trust relationship. That's outside the scope of employment. No vicarious liability. So how is it that the Archdiocese of Boston, for example, recently agreed to pay $85 million to settle cases of conduct that was clearly outside the course and scope of employment? The answer is that there's a different theory of liability. Right. And that's exactly the alternative, which is negligent hiring or supervision. I don't know if any of you saw the case, the Mary Kay Letourneau case in one of our alums, and I think he's on the board of trustees. His name is Mike Patterson. He defended the city or the school district, Tacoma School District, or wherever this was. You know, the Mary Kay Letourneau, she's the one who seduces her sixth grade student. They have a child. She gets sent to jail. She gets out of jail. She goes back, has another child from this guy who by that time is in the eighth grade or ninth grade or something. He then sues the school district. By that time, he's 19 years old, saying, essentially, your negligent hiring and supervision of this woman allowed her to exploit me. And it was on Court TV. I don't know if anybody saw them flipping through the channels. But the trial itself, his name was Veeley. What's that? Falau? Okay. The student who was the plaintiff, the jury eventually decided against him, decided the school district, neither the school district nor the Tacoma Police Department was negligent. In the Tacoma Police Department responds, you know, finds the two of them in the back of a pickup or something at 1 a.m. and I think they know him or know her. Anyway, they have reason to be suspicious about this, but they essentially, you know, well, yeah, no big deal, and go on. So, again, the claim against the employer was not that she was acting in the course and scope of employment, but that they were negligent in their hiring and supervision to prevent this when they had all sorts of indicators that that there was a problem here. Ms. Schmidt? Oh, yeah. Right. It's not so much whether they're technically on the clock. The real dividing line is between those actions which, however misguided and, in fact, deranged, the employee thought these actions were accomplishing the employer's aim. So the woman you officer you mentioned may have thought, I'm doing the right thing here, even though I know I'm violating some rules. I'm still trying to kind of get this thing resolved. As distinguished from a case in which I know perfectly well that what I'm doing is a bad thing, and I'm just doing it because I'm, you know, my employer provides a great front for me to, I can sit at my keyboard, say, David K. DeWolf, professor of law, and get people to trust me that would otherwise not do that. So, again, it, to the extent that it's clearly outside the court, you know, the person knew what they were doing was wrong, that's outside the course and scope of employment, and you've got to go over here. However, if there's a colorable argument that they thought they were doing the right thing, then you may be able to show that, however misguided, this was in the course and scope of employment. So again, the bouncer at the bar, you know, who picks up the patron and throws the patron through the plate glass window, that may violate all sorts of standards for good, you know, security practices, but you can establish that this is in the course and scope of employment because the bouncer is, you know, trying to accomplish some security purpose, however badly they're handling it. Similarly, the city of Los Angeles could be made vicariously liable for beating up Rodney King, even though these guys turn out to be convicted of a crime of violating his civil rights, if you find they were still doing police work, however badly it turned out. So, again, what you want to be clear about is, am I relying on vicarious liability where I have to show in the course and scope of employment, but I don't have to show the employer was negligent? I want to be real clear about that. The whole idea about vicarious liability is you can have a wonderful employer who does everything right. They have great training programs. They have the most selective hiring practices. They have constant seminars and encouragement and so forth to have their employees do the very, very best job. They're still vicariously liable if one of their employees makes a mistake, if it's in the course and scope of employment. We're not saying the employer is negligent. We're saying the employer is vicariously liable for what's done in the course and scope of employment. By contrast, negligent hiring and supervision permits liability for things outside the course and scope of employment. It's no part of a, you know, priest's or psychiatrist's or elementary school teacher's job to have sex with the people they're supposed to be helping. That's outside the course and scope of employment. However, if the employer has negligently hired or supervised that person, then they're potentially liable. But again, you have to show negligence, lack of reasonable care. Now, one of the things I would say from the plaintiff's standpoint that makes it hard on the defendants is, what is the standard of reasonable care if you're hiring a, you know, even a Sunday school teacher or somebody that takes, you know, Boy Scout, Girl Scout, Campfire Girls, whatever, a troop leader who takes kids off on, you know, weekend trips? How careful should you be to identify potential predators, wolves in sheep's clothing here, that are going to be attracted to these environments because of their potential to be able to exploit children? It doesn't really help you a whole lot to say, hey, look, our annual budget is $300,000. We just, you know, this guy was a friend of so-and-so, and everybody said he was a great guy, and, you know, we didn't do a criminal background check or do anything else. We just kind of, gee, you know, he loved kids. That may not cut it as far as the jury is concerned in terms of, again, sort of in a learned hand context, what's the potential harm we're talking about? what's the probability that people will masquerade as helpful folks when in fact they're vicious predators? What's the burden of running a criminal background check or other efforts supervising hiring practices that will just reduce the risk that you're going to have a bad incident on your hand? So again, from the defendant's standpoint, how do I go to a jury and say, gosh, we didn't think this was, never occurred to you. Well, it should have occurred to you folks. And therefore, failing to do that, particularly in this climate, is not acceptable. Come on. Well, in the negligent hiring supervision area, the question is, what would a reasonable person do if you're hiring someone whose responsibilities will include child care workers or other people that will have responsibility? Nursing home, again, you hire people to work the night shift in a nursing home. It's not only children, but elderly and infirm and disabled people who are vulnerable as well. Their job is to, sweep the floor or whatever, but to the extent that they have access to commit crimes, your obligation is to engage in reasonable care. Now, and again, let's make sure with respect to McGrath, the McGrath case is not a negligent hiring and supervision. We're not asking whether the law firm had prior notice that this guy was a loose cannon. The case against the law firm is one of whether he's in the course and scope of employment. By contrast, if he had had several previous incidents and they sent him out again to the bar to drink and do, this stuff, and then he got into trouble, then you might be able to show they were, negligent in their hiring and supervision of this guy. Ms. Ma? Well, the U.S. government is that... We'll basically look at that in Chapter 4, but because it has to do with the unique way in which governmental entities are held liable or restrict their liability. So why don't we wait till we get there? Other questions about vicarious? Oh, the one other thing, this is really important, I'll come back to it, is this idea of employees versus independent contractors. We'll talk about this again in the context of Fletcher versus Rylands, but employees are those people the employer has the right to control the way they do their work. Independent contractors, by contrast, are people who essentially set the terms of their own employment. When I hire a dentist to put a filling in my teeth, I don't have the right to tell him or her how to do the work. When the electrician comes to replace an outlet, I don't tell him what kind of wire to use. But if I hire somebody to mow my lawn, I do have the right to control them. They're considered an employee. So we'll talk about that a little bit more in Fletcher versus Rylands when we get there.